You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Shortly after NYPD Chief of Detectives Thomas Burns publicly criticized the London police for failing to capture Jack the Ripper, he received a letter purportedly from Jack himself saying New York was his next target. Not long after, Burns was confronted by his own Ripper-style murder case in the death of Kerry Brown, a.k.a. Old Shakespeare, a colorful character who worked as a prostitute and had a penchant for quoting Shakespeare. Given the near hysteria surrounding the vicious murder soon after the Jack the Ripper murders in London, people were worried that Jack might have actually come to America. The Detective Bureau finally arrested Amir Ben Ali, an Algerian immigrant. The newspapers, however, immediately criticized Burns for moving too quickly, suggesting that he had tried to save face by pinning the crime on an easy target. When the verdict of murder in the second degree was announced, the papers erupted in anger and disbelief. With the aid of the French consulate, they embarked on a 10-year campaign to have Ben Ali pardoned and finally won his release by producing new evidence. Immediately upon Ben Ali's departure for France, fresh evidence of his guilt surfaced. Was Ben Ali falsely convicted or falsely exonerated? And if he did not commit the murder, then who did? Issues of false convictions, fake news, illegal immigration, police corruption, and racial prejudice are common tropes in today's news cycles. The East River Ripper demonstrates that these are not simply matters of recent vintage and seeks to answer such questions in trying to determine whether and in what way justice miscarried. The book that we're featuring this evening is The East River Ripper, the mysterious 1891 murder of Old Shakespeare, with my special guest, prosecutor and author, George R. Deakle, Sr. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, George Deakle, Sr. Thank you very much. This is an extraordinary book due out the end of this month, August 31st, So glad to have you here before anybody else got the chance to talk to you.
Well, thank you. You will be the first person that has interviewed me about the book.
Incredible. Before we start this extraordinary book, you talk about your 30 years as a prosecutor. Give us your background before we start talking about the East River Ripper.
Well, I'm a fifth-generation North Floridian. Lived in a small town all my life. Went to the University of Florida. Went to law school there. Came back to my hometown and started practicing law as a public defender. Practiced as a public defender for about 2 years and then went with the state attorney's office for 30 years. And prosecuted just about every kind of crime you can imagine, from criminal mischief to capital murder. Including one of the gentlemen that you mentioned in your lead-in, Ted Bundy.
Wow. Interesting. Let's talk about, you, in your introduction, you talk about Eugene Borchans, if that's the proper pronunciation, of his 1931 book, Convicting the Innocent, an account of the wrongful conviction of Amir Ben Ali. Tell us about how you came to be the author of this book, and tell us a little bit more about Eugene Borchans' book. And you say that very much that almost every treatment of this case has been took Borchans' book and accepted those findings at face value. So tell us a little bit about Eugene Borchans' book.
Okay, well, the first time I ever heard about his book was in a voir dire of a jury back in the early 70s. A defense attorney mentioned it, asking the jurors if they'd ever read the book. Of course, he was trying to poison the minds of the jury by putting that sort of a name in front of them, and the judge got very angry with him. And I never thought anything about reading the book, but until I started to research his case, I came across the case researching the last book that I wrote, which was a book about another murder in New York City that was prosecuted by the same man who prosecuted the East River Ripper case. And in researching that book, I read his biography, and he had a chapter on this murder. And I got interested in it because it seemed like a rather interesting case, and there's some things he said in the book about the case that just didn't quite make sense. And I looked around and found some other references, found Borchardt's book, and read it was just a chapter in his book that was on the Ali case. There were a number of other, each chapter was devoted to another case about some man who was supposedly convicted and innocent. And then I found the transcript of the trial, and the transcript of the inquest that was held before the trial.
Right.
I could not reconcile Borchardt's intimation that this particular prosecutor was corrupt with my knowledge of the prosecutor. It just didn't make sense to me that the prosecutor would knowingly prosecute an innocent man. And I wanted to try to resolve the friction between those two positions. I had learned about the chief of detectives, Thomas Burns, who was a giant figure in the Gilded Age of New York, a tremendously gifted detective. And I again had some difficulty seeing him framing an innocent man. So I dug into it. I read the trial transcript. I read the all of the newspaper accounts I could find. I read the memoirs of a couple of men who were involved in the case, other men who were involved in the case. One of the doctors had written rather extensively about it, and tried to figure out, you know, what happened. Was this man really innocent, or was he guilty? Was he properly convicted, or was he railroaded? At the end of the book, I give three possible scenarios as to what happened in the case. Because, you know, this happened over 100 years ago. You can't say with certainty what happened. All you can do is say what probably happened. And there are three scenarios that fit the facts. I give the three scenarios, and then I weigh which of those three I think is the most likely. And, you know, if a reader wants to choose one of the other two scenarios, they're welcome to do it. It won't hurt my feelings at all.
Yeah.
But I think that one of those three is what happened. And a lot of the things that traditional story about the case say don't or untrue under any of those three scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
Under no scenario did the police try to frame Benally. Under no scenario was there any prosecutorial misconduct to amount to intentionally framing the man. If he was innocent under one scenario, he got himself convicted by lying like a cheap clock. Under another scenario, he got himself convicted because a man not affiliated with the police withheld crucial evidence of his innocence for 10 years and then didn't reveal it until it was his to his advantage to do it. And under the third scenario, he's guilty.
Let's start with the connection that interested the press, frightened the populace, and would interest every true crime reader, obviously, the connection to Jack the Ripper. So in your book, you talk about August 31st, 1888, Marianne Nichols, London's Whitechapel district. People heard her cries, but no one came to her aid. Her throat was cut, nearly severing her head, and he repeatedly slashed her torso. So you continue to chronicle the Emma Ellis Smith died on April 4th, 1888. Later, Martha Turner suffered 39 stab wounds. So you go through that Jack the Ripper's assault of women in Whitechapel and the horror and all of the story that emanated from the newspaper frenzy as a result.
Yeah.
But tell us about the connection, why this Jack the Ripper is connected to this story.
Okay. Well, you know, there's a tremendous amount of uproar in London over these killings, and anybody who got any prostitute who got stabbed with a knife after the first one of these murders was immediately Jack the Ripper was the person who did it. And of the 12, I think, murders that I chronicled in the first chapter, only five are reliably attributed to Jack the Ripper. But at that time,
right.
Everybody thought that Jack the Ripper did all of them. And mm-hmm. I wrote that chapter through the eyes of someone in the 19th century, not a Jack the Ripperologist looking back on it as to what it was, because Jack the Ripper was just a kind of a sidelight on the story. But anyhow, Thomas Burns was world renowned as one of the greatest detectives of the age, and he said some rather unkind things about the London police's ability to make an arrest, and they got published in the London papers, and then we got this letter supposedly from Jack the Ripper saying, "Batten down the hatches, here I come." Not long after that, a prostitute in the slums, just like Whitechapel was a slum area, and they were all prostitutes who were killed by Jack the Ripper, and a prostitute in the slum is butchered in very much the same fashion as the traditional, typical Jack the Ripper murders. She is, her genital area is butchered, her stomach is ripped open, her intestines are pulled out. The only difference between her death and the death of most of the Jack the Ripper victims is the Jack the Ripper victims had their throats cut, and the New York City victim, Carrie Brown, was strangled.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the first people coming in and looking at the scene, the first thought that came to their mind was Jack the Ripper. And so they went round and round, all kinds of speculation in the press that was this Jack the Ripper? Is Jack the Ripper come? And right after the conviction of Ali, Burns hinted that he had evidence that Ben Ali was in London during the time that the Ripper murders were being committed over there.
Right.
So you know, I doubt very seriously whether Ben Ali was Jack the Ripper.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt very seriously that Jack the Ripper came to the United States and committed a murder just to rub Thomas Burns' nose in the bragging that he had done about how the New York police would have caught the Ripper.
So you have the press in London goading over the idea that this Burns, who had from New York City, this sophisticated guy that would tell them, and that's what he wrote, that this is the techniques that he would use to employ to try to find Jack the Ripper. They were delighted that Burns now had his own Ripper on his own hands and now had the pressure to make an arrest.
Well, it wasn't so much the London press as the London police.
Mm-hmm.
They were quite pleased that Burns was in a position where he could no longer talk about them and had his own Ripper case to have to solve. You know, the traditional story was that Burns said he'd have, if Jack the Ripper came to New York City, he'd have Jack in jail within either 48 or 36 hours,
right.
depending on which version of the story you heard. And in actuality, he had Ben Ali, if Ben Ali was the actual killer, had him in jail within 12 hours. So if Burns made the boast, which he says he never did, and if Ben Ali was the murderer, he beat his boast by a good 12 to 36 hours.
Mm-hmm. You have the extraordinary status that the media had at that time. In London, Jack the Ripper invigorated the newspaper business. And so they had never seen anything like this. And so this was truly really good for the newspaper business in London. And so in New York, when they got these, I am right here and I expect to kill somebody by Thursday, so go get ready for me with your pistols, but I have a knife and has done more than your pistols. Next thing you'll hear of some women dead, yours truly, mm-hmm. Jack the Ripper. And then you talk about the New York Herald. Another note written in red ink, and he said he had just written Detective Burns that I'm in America. So this was a frenzy for the media, having this kind of crime, having these kinds of characters involved. Tell us about what Burns' response is now as an investigator in this case.
Well, Burns was extremely closed-mouthed right at the beginning, and he probably should have been even more closed-mouthed than he actually was. There's all kinds of confusion, as there always is at the outset of any kind of an investigation like this, and I've been in a number of similar type investigations, that, you know, people are running around like chickens with their head chopped off, information is coming in. It may be true. It may not be true. It gets spread around. And Byrne said some things to the press that didn't pan out. He made some intimations to the press that he knew who the murderer was, and the only thing he had to do was find him. And the murderer was a man that they call Frenchie Number Two. Ben Ali went by the nickname of Frenchie because Algeria at that time was a possession of France,
mm-hmm.
and all Algerians were subjects of France. And Frenchie had actually served as a French soldier during the Franco-Prussian War. That's how he got the name Frenchie. So Burns is saying there's Frenchie Number One and Frenchie Number Two. Frenchie Number One was simply in the hotel across the hall from where the murder occurred, and Frenchie mm-hmm. Number Two was in the hotel room with Carrie Brown murdering her. They searched for Frenchie Number Two. He finally found Frenchie Number Two, and Frenchie Number Two had an ironclad alibi. Oops. And then instead of, saying, telling the press, put out the fire and calling the dogs, we're not interested in Frenchie Number Two anymore, he didn't say anything because that's kind of egg on his face. And then he arrests Frenchie Number One. And this kind of, raises the antennas of people say, hey, what's going on here? Is he being shooting straight with us, or is he dealing off the bottom of the deck? There's something ain't right here. So this rouses suspicion of the press. And they became quite confrontational with him after that. So that kind of started the sourness between him and the press.
Can you explain for us what we haven't talked about is anything about who this Carrie Brown was. You give this background that once upon a time she was doing quite well. She ruined her life with alcohol. Tell us a little bit about Carrie Brown, but also this Frenchie 1, Frenchie 2, and this notorious hotel that you say that this was not the only homicide, and in fact there had been a homicide in this room before. It was called
exactly.
The Rains Hotel. So it was the kind of hotel you write, that you could get a drink in the basement and then go upstairs with a lady of the evening. So that's the kind
that's
of
right.
hotel it was. So
you can buy
tell us
a drink.
First about this. Tell us first about the rooms 31 and 33 and their significance. And then also we didn't mention an extraordinary thing was a symbol was carved on one buttocks and her genitals were slashed. So tell us about the room scenario. And then more about the blood and the blood that was found and the condition of Carrie Brown.
Okay. Well, first off, Carrie Brown was a very respectable woman at one point in her life, a mother, the wife of a sea captain. And she took to drink and basically ruined her life. Now, her husband was actually a captain of a ship in the Union Navy during the Civil War. But he finally got fed up with her, divorced her, and she wound up moving to New York, worked for a while as an actress, and the supposition is that's where she picked up all her lines from Shakespeare.
Right.
And finally the drink got her so bad that the only way she could make a living was as a prostitute. One place that she frequented to work as a prostitute was this East River Hotel, also known as the Fourth Ward Hotel, also known as the House of All Drinks. And on the first floor was a bar, and in the bar was where the men and the women would meet up. They would drink. They would agree on services to be rendered, and then they would retire to the upstairs. It was a five-story hotel, and the way they numbered, stories back in the 1890s, there was a ground floor, first, second, third, and fourth floor. So the fourth floor is what we'd actually call the fifth floor. But anyhow, up on the top floor was where Carrie Brown went with her John on the night of her murder. They met. They bought a bucket of beer for a nickel to go up the stairs, or one stairwell going up to the top floor, and up the stairs, down the hall. At the end of the hall was room 33, and it was the best room, probably the best room in the house, because it had two windows. It was a corner house. They retired into that room. And later that night, Ben Ali came in, and he rented room 33, which was right across the hall. Carrie and her John were in room 31,
right.
And Ben Ali was in room 33, which was right across the hall, catty cornered across the hall. Okay, at some point during the night, the John left, and then early that morning, Ben Ali left, and the janitor saw him leaving, and nobody saw the John leave. When Ben Ali left, the janitor saw him leaving, and he said he looked like he was sneaking out. And then when the maid went up to check on the rooms, make sure everybody was out, she found the body. I say the maid. I forget whether it was the maid or the janitor that found the body. But the room, the door was locked. It had to be unlocked. And so the killer had left the room, locked the door, and the key was gone. So they had to get the master key to go in.
Tell us what was carved on her buttocks.
There was a cross carved on her buttock. She was naked, sprawled under the cover. Bedclothes and her shift had been wrapped around her head, and there's a pretty graphic description from the autopsy report of the carving, the depth of the carving, and whatnot, and the slashes to her vaginal area and her. Deep, ragged, lengthy slashes, and part of her intestines, small intestines, had been taken out and placed between her legs. And there was a bloody knife found in the bed beside her.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop just for a second for these messages. You talked about the incredible that Carrie Brown was left in, mutilated with her intestines out of her body positioned. But what about the police arriving once they were called? You mentioned Edward Fitzgerald, the janitor, and then someone that had also was involved, another William Thomas. So police arrive. Tell us about the blood evidence in 33 and 31 when the police arrive. Tell us about the media arriving with the coroner. Tell us about this whole incredible situation that arises.
Okay, well, the police arrive. I think it was Captain O'Connor who was the first first officer to look at in the scene. He just looks at the door. God, that's awful. Need to call the coroner. Backs out. He places a an officer by the name of Malarkey down at the bottom of the stairwell. Nobody goes up. Nobody comes down. Maintain crime scene integrity until the coroner gets here. Now, at this point, nobody has noticed any blood stains outside of the room.
Right.
You know, there's blood all over the room, room 31, but nobody's noticed any blood stains in the hallway or anywhere else on the top floor. The coroner finally arrives, and Coroner Schultz is a man I was familiar with because he was a coroner in the previous book, previous case that I wrote a book about. And not to put too fine a point on it, but Coroner Schultz was a nincompoop. he botched the coroner's investigation in the previous case that I wrote about, and he screwed up the investigation in this case also. The coroner is a public official. He has authority, and so he traipses up to room 31, which he has the authority to do, and carries about a dozen newspaper reporters with him.
Right.
Okay. Now crime scene integrity is ruined. And not only do they go up on the fourth floor with him, they go into the murder scene with him. But he is absolutely positive, certain, you know, that they didn't touch anything and they didn't step in any blood. They just stood there and gawked while he examined the body. And so they get the parade of reporters out and gone, and the police, more police officers arrive. They start looking around. They're trying to determine, you know, places that could have been used for escape, trying to see if there's any evidence that they could be found, and they see blood stains on the floor, on the hallway, and on the door. And they follow the bloodstains, and they're very minute bloodstains, across the hall into room 33. And they find bloodstains in room 33, which has been Ali's room. Okay, now, I think the first thing in the morning when they get there, when the police arrive, and nobody has noticed any bloodstains outside of the room until 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
Okay, which would have been fine if they had had good crime scene integrity from the time they arrived, the time that Officer Malarkey had been stationed at the bottom of the stairwell to keep people out and the time that they went to processing the scene. Now you've got all kinds of potential for some reporter possibly got blood on the bottom of his shoe and tracked it out. So, you know, there's great weakness in the bloodstain evidence outside the room and in room 33 even, because a rumor got circulated after the trial that a couple of reporters decided they'd string blood all over the top floor of the hotel to make this crime more sensational than it already was, which, you know, sounded to me like a ridiculous story, but that was mm-hmm. the rumor that was being bandied about. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the received story is that the officers planted all this evidence up there. But, you know, it's, there's a British official who was being accused of a conspiracy theory, some sort of a conspiracy one time, and he said, no, the conspiracy theory doesn't explain what happened. A cock-up theory explains what happened.
Yeah.
And you know, if the blood was not left by the perpetrator, it was left by accident as a result of the incompetence of
mm-hmm.
the coroner. So, you know, you don't need a conspiracy theory or corrupt police to explain the presence of the bloodstains in the hallway. And even more than that, you don't need to be too critical of the police not for them not to have noticed the bloodstains if they were there that morning before 4 in the afternoon.
Right.
Because they had a lot of things going on. That was a horrific scene. And it's easy to overlook small things like minuscule bloodstains. And I mm-hmm. gave a few examples of things being overlooked
sure.
on homicide scenes that I was involved in. As a matter of fact, two of them, bodies were overlooked, bodies mm-hmm. of homicide victims.
Let's talk about the idea now that they believe that Ben Ali is once they had dismissed him as a suspect, now they believe he is the killer. And so now they quickly organize a coroner's inquest, which would ends up being just like a preliminary because it's certainly not a trial. So
yeah.
Tell us about the arrest of Ben Ali and also the idea that his grasp of English, how good is it? And what do they do in response to that?
Okay, well, the criminal procedure in New York at the time, homicides, when you had a homicide, you started off with a coroner's inquest
right.
to determine if there was a criminal act and who was responsible for it. And then you held a preliminary hearing, which they called an examination.
Right.
And then you had a trial. Okay. In Ben Ali's case, they held the coroner's inquest, and then his lawyers waived the examination of the preliminary hearing, and then we just went straight to trial. I think that Burns had his eye on Ben Ali from the very beginning.
Why?
As a possibility, because they he's talking about Frenchie number two. We got to find Frenchie number two, and he does that for a period of days. We're looking for Frenchie number two, but all the time he's looking for Frenchie number two, they're taking Benalee's clothing and cutting bloodstains out of it to be examined by a lab analyst, Dr. Edson. They're taking his socks, because there's a bloodstain on his sock, to Dr. Edson, and they are digging the dirt out from under his fingernails to take to Dr. Edson to be examined on the possibility that there's blood under his fingernails. And right. So they're doing all those things, and it doesn't seem to me like they would be doing all those things if they didn't have some suspicion that he was a man. They arrested him as a material witness, but I think they suspected all along that he very well could have been the person who did it.
Right. You talk about the material witnesses. This is interesting, that the material witnesses are, in fact, incarcerated in the House of Detention for witnesses. I thought that was interesting, that they knew where exactly those witnesses were because they were behind bars, essentially.
Exactly. You know, that's something that was done even up until quite recently in Florida. I remember when I was in high school, we had a rape case that got a lot of bad publicity because the victim was put in jail and the accused was released on bail. So the victim's sitting in jail waiting for trial, and the defendant is out walking the street. Of course, we don't do that in Florida anymore. But that was over 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, at this coroner's inquest, again, like you say, they waive the examination afterwards, and then they go right to trial. But at this inquest, there is a little bit of an audition of how evidence will work, and there's a prosecutor named Wellman, and you alluded to him already. Yeah, you talk about reading his memoir later on. But so tell us, just briefly, because we've got to get to the most important thing, which is the trial. Anything extraordinary at that inquest? And again, I ask, how did they accommodate this Ben Ali's? Apparently, he couldn't speak English very well. So how did they accommodate him at this inquest and at trial?
They accommodated him with translators, interpreters. I forget the names of the interpreters at the inquest. I think it was Constance Burko and a gentleman by the name of Martin, who were the interpreters at the inquest. Mm-hmm. And then at the trial, Martin was replaced by a man who's name escapes me. I can't remember where
Sultan.
Farmer
are. Sultan. His name is Sultan.
Okay. Miss Sultan, that's right. And but anyhow, that's how they did it. Frenchie or Ben Ali spoke a language. It was a kind of a mixture of French and Algerian or Arabic. It's kind of like, you know, on the border of Texas and Mexico, they speak a kind of a mixed language called Tex-Mex.
Right.
That was the language that Frenchie spoke. So they had at the trial or at the inquest, they had a French interpreter and an Arabic interpreter. So they could get him. Make sure he knew everything that was going on. Of course, he also spoke English quite well.
He exhibited
a syndrome that I had noticed people from outside the country who get themselves arrested and charged with crimes, they forget how to speak English. And that just kind of bogs the process down. You have to get them an interpreter.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop right now to talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why, especially when it comes to something we take every day. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients in bioavailable forms your body can actually use. What you won't find? Sugars, GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, and artificial colorants. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed-release capsule design make taking your vitamins easy. I chose to take Ritual Essential for Men 50+ about 8 months ago when it became available for men and teens. I decided to try it because my wife Lisa has been taking Ritual Essential for women for over 2 years, and she is impressed with the results of taking Ritual daily and has felt it has made a significant difference in her health. And I wanted to experience Ritual for myself. Their research into bioavailable vitamin and mineral sources has sold me on Ritual. They are a superior multivitamin. Ritual is the multivitamin reimagined. A multivitamin should contain key ingredients and nutrients in forms your body can actually use to help fill gaps in the diet. No shady extras. Ritual's delayed-release capsule design delivers high-quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. Get key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. Now, we talked about Frenchie at the inquest, and then later we'll be talking about Frenchie at this trial. But he has this interpreter there, and when there is the sentence and the conviction at this inquest, when they have their determination, he believes that he doesn't understand that it's just an inquest. What is his behavior at this inquest when he is frustrated or posed certain questions? Tell us how he acts, and let's get to...
Okay, well, he didn't answer any questions at the inquest, other than just a few questions that were put to him by the coroner, and filled out on a sheet. But he was sullen, he was morose, uncooperative. He would get rather vocal at times, but he really showed out at the trial when he actually testified before the jury. That might have been the turning point of the case as far as him getting himself convicted, was the way he behaved on the witness stand.
And what was that? How did he act?
He basically acted like a wild man. He jumped up and down, waved his arms, shouted, evaded the questions that he was being asked by the prosecutor. And the prosecutor did a very stupid thing. He took the knife and Okay, this is a man he believes to be a mad dog killer.
Yeah.
And walks over to him and hands him the knife.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not a real good idea to hand a deadly weapon to a man that you think is the mad dog killer. And Frenchie erupts, or Ben Ali erupts, and waves the knife and whoops and hollers and scares the mud out of the prosecutor. And the judge calls out, "Take that knife away from him." And they get the knife away from him, and it showed Frenchie in a whole different light from the way that he had been trying to portray himself in front of the jury. He looked like a man who could rip somebody to pieces with a knife. Up to that point, he'd been in front of the jury. He had been meek, mild, bent over, trying to act as pitiful as he possibly could. I'm pretty sure that the defense attorneys had tried their best to get him not to take a witness stand, but he insisted on taking the witness stand, and I think that he went a long way towards sinking his case when he did.
Mm. You write about the. This is impressive, too, and I've read this about other cases, but it's still shocking and startling for people to read now, about the crowds and the mobs that were everywhere outside the courtroom. At every point, there was a huge crowd. And in fact, you write, at one point, the police had to fight off these.
Yeah.
It was beyond curious onlookers. They had to fight them off physically. And the media was very sympathetic. You say there was some not... They weren't all in agreement, but the media was sympathetic towards Ali, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. At that time in New York City, I think there was a newspaper on every street corner.
Mm-hmm.
There were the story was massively covered by the newspapers. Some of the newspapers were skeptical of Ben Ali's poor pitiful me act.
Mm-hmm.
And his me no speak of the English act. But most of them, they swallowed the hook, line, and sinker. And they portrayed him as being the poor, friendless child of the desert who was being crushed in the cogs of this relentless legal system that was being completely unfair to him.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's the way they played it.
At the same time at this trial, you talk of the, in your mind, quite impressive forensics, especially given the time. And this does come down to the forensic evidence, and that being something to do with those intestines that were taken out of the body. So tell us what evidence they had that pointed at Ali and his involvement with those intestines.
The most damning evidence against Ben Ali came from under his fingernails. You can forget the bloodstains in his room, room 33. You can forget the bloodstains on his clothes. You can forget the bloodstains in the hall. The bloodstains under his fingernails were examined by two of the most forensic doctors, medico-legal men in the nation at that time. I mean, they were head and shoulders above everybody else in the country as far as their ability, skills, and abilities. And they came up and they said the blood under his fingernails came out of Kerry Brown's intestines. And they not only said that it came out of Kerry Brown's intestines, they said that it came out of a certain specific portion of Kerry Brown's intestines. And the kicker is that they said this before they got the autopsy report. And then they went and got the autopsy. Well, as a matter of fact, there were two of them. There was a little bit of discussion. Dr. Flint said, you know, this comes from this portion of the woman's intestines. And Dr. Format said, wait a minute, I ain't saying, I'm sure they may have come from the large intestines. You know, Format says no, and Flint says no, they come from the small intestines, and they come from this part of the small intestines, the blood comes. And so they went and got the autopsy report, hadn't got the autopsy report yet. They bring the autopsy report in, they open it up, they read it, and the only part of her intestines is cut is the part of the intestines that Dr. Flint said the blood came from.
So he was correct.
And, you know, they were doing forensics that a modern crime lab would have a hard time doing.
Wow.
And it's at the end of the coroner's inquest, the prosecution had a losing case. They had one doctor who was out of his league that had examined the blood. And the case was not strong. And they did what lawyers frequently do, is they waited until the last daggum minute to see about trying to shore up that evidence and recruit some experts who knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so as they're picking the jury, Dr. Format and Dr. Flint are going back over the examination that Dr. Edson did and finding all kinds of things. And when they get through with their examination, the blood under Frenchie's fingernails either came from Kerry Brown's intestines or the intestines of some other woman who had eaten the same kind of food Kerry Brown had the same illness that Kerry Brown had, and also had intestinal parasites, the same intestinal parasites that Kerry Brown had.
Wow.
And I don't think there's no record of another woman in New York City that night that got killed exactly just like that. So any theory of Ben and Lee's innocence has got to account for what is Kerry Brown's blood doing under his fingernails.
Yeah. You write about the legal team of Friend, House, and Levy, with the big star being this House. And
yes,
he had previously, earlier, had been sick. They said something about exhaustion, physical exhaustion, but he was physically sick. But then he came to. You write about how eloquent he was and how he tried to defend this alley, and also what strategy they employed to do this. Tell us a little bit about this eloquent-sounding, experienced attorney House and Friend and Levy and their strategy to defend.
Well, the most criminal trials that I have been involved in, boil down to a war between logic on one side and emotion on the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's usually the prosecution that has the logic, and it's the defense that has the emotion. That's one thing I really liked about trying circumstantial evidence murder cases. You can't generate a whole lot of emotion for the defendant in a circumstantial evidence murder. But anyhow, that's beside the point. So they play Ben Ali up as ignorant, innocent, stranger in a strange land, who has just been confronted and run over by this massive bureaucracy of the New York Police Department, just totally unable to defend himself because of his lack of ability to speak, his lack of understanding. Have you heard that country song, Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the song that he was singing, Poor, Poor, Pitiful He. Poor, Poor, Pitiful Ali. And he did an excellent job of making this person, making him as sympathetic as he possibly could, and at the same time making the witnesses who had testified against him as unattractive as possible. Because who have you got testifying for the prosecution? You have a bunch of prostitutes and pimps and drunkards. And then you have the police, of course. On the one hand, we've got this this poor, pitiful guy who's being run over by the police, and they're depending on gutter snipes pulled out of the worst slums of the city to try to convict him, and that's the story he's pitching to him. And of course, you know, he waves the flag. We're in America. Presumption of innocence. You know, despite the fact that he's this poor child of the desert is so ignorant and unlettered and whatnot. That doesn't mean that he doesn't have the same presumption of innocence. It didn't have the same presumption of innocence as anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the pitch he made. It was a good one.
Yeah.
Before the right jury, it could have worked.
Now, despite the media support, despite an eloquent House and in his opening statement, his closing statement, a valiant effort by Friend, House, and Levy, and even the testimony of Frenchie once again, Ali, what is the verdict? And you talk about this being a capital case. He was charged for first-degree murder, but explain, the jury has discretion with that degree of murder, don't they?
Yeah, the law, as it relates to lesser-included offenses, is, you know, every first-degree murder includes within it a second-degree murder and manslaughter, and in some jurisdictions, third-degree murder also. You know, if you commit first-degree murder, you've also committed all those lesser-included offenses.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are charged with first-degree murder, and the jury is not satisfied that first-degree murder is proven, then they can find the defendant guilty of the lesser crime, the second-degree murder or manslaughter.
Mm.
And the judge instructs the jury on those lesser offenses, and the jury then has the discretion to find the defendant guilty of a lesser included offense. And that's what they did in this particular case. And the press frothed at the mouth about that. Said, "Oh, it's it's first degree murder or it's nothing." I used to say when I was a defense attorney talking to a jury, I said they may be strikes, they may be a ball, but ain't nothing till the umpire calls. And it may be first degree murder, it may be not, but it ain't anything until the jury makes his pronouncement. And the jury made his pronouncement, and they pronounced it second-degree murder, so that's what it is.
What was Ali's reaction at this verdict? Post-conviction.
At first he thought he was going to be executed.
Right.
They explained to him, no, he wasn't going to be executed, and he was relieved at that point. He was not real happy with having to spend the rest of his life in prison, but that beats the alternative.
Right. We missed to talk about that at one point in this trial, they tried to employ jailhouse informants or people that came forward and said that Ali had a gun in prison previously, was in for a little stint.
You mean a knife?
Not much was made of that. But so now that he is convicted, are the same attorneys considering an appeal? What happens in that regard?
Okay, they file a notice of appeal, and then there's no record of any opinion by the appellate court. My take on that would be, well, they got a per curiam affirmance. In other words, it was affirmed without opinion. That's why there's no opinion. Apparently the appellate court didn't see anything wrong with the case as far as any error was concerned. And it was, it was a pretty clean case. There was, there were things that they did, that the prosecution did, that today would cause a mistrial. Things that were said. The prosecution said some things that would offend the 21st century sensibilities, but they said the 19th century, and the defense sat right there and did not object.
Right.
It was a different time, different standards. If you're going to criticize the prosecution for something, that would probably be what I'd criticize them for.
Right.
And the funny part of it is, or the ironic part of it is I think that the prosecutor who made those statements, Delancey Nickel, honestly, sincerely thought he was trying to be fair. He was so blind to the racial prejudice that he was espousing, that he didn't realize that it was unfair.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe
let's use this as an opportunity. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, you talked about that pretty well. You said you describe it, depict it as a clean trial. It was well done. There was no misconduct, we'll say. Now, there was a person that was present the day, apparently, that Coroner Schultz went up to the room. His name is Jacob Riss.
Yes.
What happens in the ensuing 10 years, as we alluded to in the title, with this Jacob Riss, the newspaper man, and the fate of Ben Ali?
Okay. Well, Ben Ali, there's continuing newspaper articles during the time that Ben Ali is in prison about how he was railroaded and about what a hard time he's having. And he melted down in prison and wound up being sent to a mental institution. Mm-hmm. Might have A1, mental institution. And so like I said, a Frenchie or Ben Ali served in the French army. And the French consulate had assisted the defense during the trial. You know, this poor and friendless man had the assistance of the French government at the trial. And over the years, while he was in prison, there was a continuing sporadic sort of newspaper campaign of dropping articles about this poor man who's in prison, and continuing efforts on the part of the French consulate to have him pardoned. There were, I forget exactly how many pardon petitions that were presented to how many different governors, at least three governors.
Right.
Governor Flower, Governor Roosevelt, and finally Governor, oh gosh, lost his name, the governor who actually mm-hmm. commuted his sentence. Can't remember his name, but anyhow. There's a sort of a PR campaign on the part of the papers and a sort of a legal campaign on the part of the French consulate. And over the years, more and more support was gotten for it. And they thought that they had a pretty good shot at it. Okay, it was a Governor Black was one of the governors.
That's right. That's right.
And then the fourth governor who actually pardoned him, I still can't remember his name. But anyway, when Black was governor was when they thought they were going to be able to get him pardoned for sure. And he brained another inmate with a club, and that kind of ruined that pardon attempt. And they came back when Roosevelt was governor, and Roosevelt turned the pardon petition down. He said there was no evidence of innocence. There was no way of nothing to change the verdict.
Mm-hmm.
And they said at that time that they thought that they were going to give it another shot. They thought they might be able to find some evidence of innocence. So after Roosevelt gets out of office, they come back to the next governor.
Odell,
that's right. Benjamin Odell. And they've got a man who says that I know who Carrie Brown's John was. He worked for me. His name was Frank.
Mm-hmm.
And the night that Carrie Brown was murdered, he came back to the farm where I live real late at night, and he had a bloody shirt, and then he up and left without giving even a forwarding address, and left a key in his room. And I took the key and went down to the East River Hotel, and I compared it to the keys on the keyboard up there on the East River Hotel keyboard behind the counter there, and by golly, it was identical to those East River Hotel keys.
Wow.
So it was he's good for it. He's the man that, that did the murder, Frank. And I decided I wouldn't say anything about it, because that man who's sitting in jail facing the death penalty for the murder. He's a bad man. He need to be in jail anyway. So I waited for 10 years before I come forward with this information. And no, I don't remember Frank's last name.
They called him Frank the Dane. That's
Frank
all
the Dane.
You write
Danish. Yeah, I called him Frank the Dane. Frank the Disappearing Dane.
Yeah.
Despite
any credibility to this story, does it work? Does the media accept it?
Oh, the media swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. Pointed out by Austin Flint in his memoirs, no investigation was done to check on the veracity of the story.
Right.
And when they pitched this information to the governor, Governor O'Dell, nobody from the district attorney's office showed up to oppose it. Okay?
Right.
And Governor O'Dell, despite the one-sided presentation at the hearing that he held, despite the lack of opposition to the pardon by the district attorney's office, and the district had a different district attorney at that time, who,
right,
by the way, did not like the New York Police Department. But despite, you know, all of that, and despite the support of some very prominent people, O'Dell does not pardon the Frenchie. Nobody noticed that O'Dell didn't pardon him. He commuted his sentence.
Right.
And the terms of commutation were, if he ever got convicted of another felony, he'd go back to prison for the rest of his life. And he commuted his sentence and made arrangements to turn him over to the French consulate and put his carcass on a boat back to Europe.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and he says in his order commuting the sentence that he doesn't mean to reflect anything on the quality of police work or anything else. There's just enough doubt that this is the right thing to do. So he
right.
does it. And I made the observation that. You know, it would have been nice to see this honest citizen who waited 10 years to come forward with the key cross-examined about that.
Mm-hmm.
And after the book was out, a friend of mine who was interested in the case found a newspaper article where this guy had testified in another lawsuit, and somehow the lawyer on the other side had got to cross-examine him about the key and about the finding, and the guy melted down on cross-examination.
Yeah.
So, you know, he would not have been able to withstand a competent cross-examination by a competent prosecutor if they'd had a full-blown hearing.
Yeah.
And I wish I'd have known that out of that book.
You talk about Ali and him departing for France immediately. And in the introduction, we talk about that they finally thought they had new evidence to exonerate him. But soon after, in the introduction, you write that fresh evidence of his guilt surfaced. Well, what was that fresh evidence that made these people rethink their positions, or at least what new evidence came and surfaced?
Sultan, the interpreter Sultan,
mm-hmm.
unfamiliar with the requirements of somebody who's working for the defense, and unfamiliar, I think, with attorney-client privilege, told a friend of his that Frenchie had confessed to him.
Yeah.
And he gave him the substance of the confession. Actually, it wasn't a confession. It was, I was supposed to meet Carrie. I was supposed to meet Carrie after she got through with her business because he and she were boyfriend and girlfriend. And I went into the room and she was butchered and I got my hands in her entrails and that's how I got the blood under my fingers, is basically a story. That kind of a story, which, you know, if that had been the only story he ever told, he might have got off by telling that story. You know, the kind of an Agatha Christie sort of a an ending to it. But anyhow, that was a statement that he'd made to Sultan. And Sultan had told this friend of his, and who was an actor. And when the news that Frenchie had been pardoned, none of the newspapers wrote that he had been, his sentence had been commuted. They wrote that he had been pardoned.
Yeah.
And Thompson was saying, wait a daggum minute. He confessed.
Yeah.
And a reporter got wind of the fact that Thompson was telling some of his friends that Frenchie had confessed, and so the reporter went and talked to him about it, asked him about it, and wrote an article about it. And that appeared in one newspaper in Buffalo, New York, and found absolutely no reporting of it in any New York City newspaper.
Yeah.
Because, you know, who wants to... they're kind of like Burns with his Frenchie number two did it.
Sure.
Kind of egg on the face if they were to run that story.
Yeah. It's an extraordinary tale. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about the East River Ripper, the mysterious 1891 murder of old Shakespeare. It's been fascinating talking to you about this, George. So for people that might want to check this out, do you have an Amazon page? You mentioned your other book that you have written recently.
Yeah,
you go to
I've got an
Amazon page?
Sorry. Yeah, I got an Amazon page, and I've also got a page myself at www.bobdeaclebooks.com. That's www.bobdeaclebooks.com. I've written about 9 other books, and all of them having to do with criminal law, and most of them historic murder trials.
That's fascinating. Again, George, thank you so much for coming on and talking about the East River Ripper, the mysterious 1891 murder of old Shakespeare. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having
me. Have a great
me.
Evening. Thank you so much. Good night.
Bye.